Yesterday we got as far as indirectness, and there are a few more things to mention about indirectness, I think, before we go on to the real business of language and power. Indirectness is very interesting because it keeps coming up. It's something that you a reference you have to make when you talk about power relationships, because some of them refuse to use indirectness. That is, indirectness is bad in some kind of relationships. In others, it's a preferred way of doing things. So we have to look at this business of not saying what we mean and why it is we actually do that. Because, you know, if you sit there and in your most logical moments wonder why would we go around saying things unless we actually mean literally what we say. And of course, there are a number of reasons. I mentioned a couple that there's a payoff in independence if you're being indirect. The classic case, the politician who doesn't really want to go on the record as advocating something very specific, and so they're very vague and indirect about their comments on tax cuts or whatever, so that the next time they're asked about it, they can change it a little bit. It's sort of also a mechanism of self-defense. Well, I really didn't say that. What I meant was, you always have a chance of clarifying yourself later if you're backed into a corner. There's also a payoff in rapport, because if you're indirect, it's sort of like declining to use your power. You're giving the other person choices. They can interpret things the way they want. The case of, can I go to the movies? Well, you can if you want to. You know, there's sort of an implied inference there. I'm not too enthused about it, but, you know, it's your choice. But I think one of the things, we're going to see that directness or indirectness characterizes different contexts that we get into, and also it characterizes different habits. When we begin to talk a little bit about differences between people and differences, say, between the genders, you find that, for example, women are more often indirect than men. And that if we enumerate some of the characteristics that differentiate different ways of speaking by genders, you find indirectness is important to women. And that is one of the things that sort of defines what the differences are. We've also mentioned things about the truth and how multifaceted the truth is. We've also discussed or mentioned all those assumptions that are behind what we say, the parts of the frame that go into or are the information that we use when we talk, and the assumptions about what it is the speaker knows and what it is we're trying to say and what we're trying to accomplish here in this conversation and so forth. We find that directness itself, being literal, is also not sufficient. It doesn't work. And part of that is, remember that the messages all come in wrappers, right? And people pay attention not only to the message, but also the wrapper. And so they don't necessarily believe the message without a signal in the wrappers that that's what it's really about. See what I mean? And that's how we get to the place where sometimes we'll say, now what did you really mean by that? You say something like, I think we should go out to eat tonight. And that may be a way of opening a negotiation. I looked in the fridge and I wasn't enthused about what I found. And it, on a literal basis, that's an assertion. We should do something, right? But it may not be meant as that. It may be meant as, let's have a discussion about what to do about supper. We might make omelets, or we might, you know, go to McDonald's, or we might do something else. But it's indirectly a way, in the indirectness of that statement, it's a way of opening a discussion, and it's a way of observing some of those maxims and establishing a rapport that, well, let's decide together. If you took everyone literally, of course, there would be lots of confrontation. Well, I don't want to go out for supper. You have to listen to the wrapper that it comes in and understand how it was meant. What was the intention of the speaker? Did the speaker really want to establish a particular course of action or just start a discussion? And of course, the other thing about the truth is sometimes it's too much. It's just too much information, and sometimes it's the wrong information. You ever have one of those invitations you really didn't want to accept? Let's go to dinner tomorrow night. And you have all sorts of indirect replies. Well, I'll have to look at my calendar. You know, and what you do there is indirectly you're trying to get out of saying yes without appearing to say no. And you start this kind of negotiation. We think of it as kind of wiggling out of something. And the wiggling, of course, is in saying a lot of things that lead to the conclusion that you don't go out for dinner, but you didn't have to flatly say no. Why? Well, you didn't want to hurt somebody's feelings. And there are the cases where, let's say, someone wants to strike up a relationship with someone and they repeatedly ask them out for dinner. And they repeatedly find more and more creative excuses to wiggle out. And finally, you know, the person gets the message. Are you really busy, or you just want to say no and you don't want to go out to dinner with me? Is that, which is it? You know, and that's sort of, you come down to the crunch there after a while. Indirectness, you know, does eventually come home to roost in such situations. I think it's important to think of this idea of listening to the wrapper or the meta message, that is, the message that's on top of the message. There are some interesting exchanges you can see where you can see if you're an observer, you can see the two people are really observing different parts of the exchange. One is saying something and meaning it rather literally. The other one is understanding the wrapper rather than the literal message. And this is a classic way that miscommunication results. Now, there's a play written by Jules Pfeiffer. You know, may know the Pfeiffer cartoons and that appear in some of the newspapers, and called Grown Ups, which is a sarcastic name, sarcastic title, Grown Ups. And Jake and Louise are two characters in there. They have a daughter, Edie, who's 9 years old. And they're sitting in the living room, and Edie is calling. And in the midst of this, Jake says to Louise, "Look, I don't care if it's important or not. When a kid calls its mother, the mother should answer." Louise says, "Now I'm a bad mother." Right? Jake was referring only to the exchange of discussion, but Louise listened to the implication, right? Part of the wrapper, the assumptions behind it. Well, if you don't answer the child, you're a bad mother. Jake says, of course, "I didn't say that." "It's in your stare," she says. Jake says, "Is that another thing you know, my stare?" And this goes on for a while, and then things get worse, of course. Louise says, "If I'm such a terrible mother, do you want a divorce?" This is that spiraling misunderstanding, you know. It just goes from bad to worse. Jake says, I don't think you're a terrible mother, and no, thank you, I do not want a divorce. Why is it that whenever I bring up any difference between us, you ask me if I want a divorce? And of course, this goes on, and Jake keeps denying there's any more meaning to the message than was literally in it, right? And Louise keeps trying to ferret out more and more meanings out of just the little statements that he made. Finally, he goes into this long speech. I have brought up one thing that you do with Edie that I don't think you noticed that I have noticed for some time, but which I have deliberately not brought up before because I had hoped you would notice it for yourself and stop doing it. And also, frankly, baby, I have to say this. I knew if I brought it up, we'd get into exactly the kind of circular argument we're in right now. And I want to avoid it. But I haven't, and we're in it, so now with your permission, I'd like to talk about it. Louise says, you don't see how that puts me down? Jake says, what? Louise says, if you think I'm so stupid, why do you go on living with me? See, again, she listened to the wrapper of that big long speech and concludes, now he thinks I'm stupid. Jake says finally, damn it, why can't anything ever be simple around here? And this is Pfeiffer is a cartoonist, right? And this is a verbal caricature of one of these arguments. You have two people listening to entirely different things. And actually, it's also a fairly characteristic of men's and women's speech. Men tend to focus on the literal and the statement itself, and women's pay more attention to the wrappers, the implications, the things that come with the statement, which also have an effect or an influence on how you understand the literal truth of what is said. I'm sure we all can imagine conversations like that, perhaps not quite the ones that get so intense quite so quickly, but you can imagine how a lot of miscommunication is based on this kind of listening for different things. And this is the problem with ordinary everyday conversations. As I said, there is such a broad spectrum of many aspects of truth. And in addition, there are so many underlying assumptions when we're talking. And we tend sometimes to abstract away from them and just pay attention to the ones that we want. Because when we are talking, we are focusing on particular aspects of things and we have certain intentions. We want to get those across. And there may be others, like I said, the excess baggage that comes along anyway. And in fact, the person listening may be paying attention to the excess baggage and not the stuff we're focusing on. And that's where we get into trouble. The problem is we can't say everything at once, and not everybody does it the same way. So there is a problem of how do you repair these miscommunications? What kind of repair strategies do we have? Can anyone think of any way to fix up that conversation that went so...
They could get a divorce.
How do you stop a conversation like that in its tracks? I mean, yes.
I think one thing you make a statement and then ask the other person, "What did you know? What did I say?
How do you think I said? What did you hear?"
Okay.
And then if it comes back, like you said, then you make another statement, or no, that's not what I said. What I meant to say, well, you know, and you sort of dialogue it that way.
That's a form of kind of stepping back and say, you step outside the discussion and you sort of have
the guy stuck his foot in and it gets in it.
Well, you try to take a look at it, though, from a different perspective at what's going on here, you know, and you can actually say, are we miscommunicating here? Conversational analysts say that one way to do that, to step back, is to name the frame. That is, try to characterize some of the assumptions surrounding this a little bit. And, of course, you can then get in an argument about that. That's remember that, you know, there's nothing foolproof here, but there are ways of trying to stop this kind of back and forth stuff. There's another kind of, well, it might be in some instances a variation of this, but a kind of miscommunication that I guess you could call it much ado about nothing. Those little things that suddenly become big ones. Because it turns out you get an argument not over the thing itself, like who's going to get up and get the next cup of coffee. You know, you could, there are various things you could have little discussions about. Well, I got the last one, or, but very easily you can get off into arguing about the assumptions. You know, well, I don't know that I want another cup of coffee. And you're now discussing not the practical matter of just walking over to the coffee pot, but what each other's intentions and desires are, which is a different thing altogether. In fact, somebody called these kind of arguments Andy Rooney arguments. You know, those Andy Rooney spots that, don't you hate it when... You know, and he finds some minuscule little thing that people get irritated about, you know, and those, they create Andy Rooney discussions, except there are two people involved instead of just him on the TV going on and it's little tirades about whatever, can openers that don't work or whatever. But that's a form of miscommunication too. The literal thing itself, like a can opener that doesn't work, is a minor irritation. It's the talk about it and how it affects you that ends up becoming the big discussion. Yes.
Some people enjoy these escalating patterns, and they enjoy getting into a major argument over small things. And if you know that that's the case,
yes.
I think it's the best thing to say, could we take up this conversation later and take a break from it? Excuse yourself for some reason and not feed into this anger and get angry. We've had experience working with foster kids, and we've had more than one that was a turmoil junkie.
Yes. Actually, you know, I have known people like this, that where they get their fun from having what you might call impassioned debate, right? The best thing to do with people like this is find them another person just like them. And they can both go into a discussion with the same set of assumptions, that we're really going to go at it hammer and tongs, and then we'll go sit down and have a nice cup of coffee when it's over. There they understand that we're just doing this for the exercise. You know, the problem becomes when people have two different sets of assumptions, and one of them is taking some of those assumptions very earnestly, and the other one's just having a good run at it, you know, and that can yeah. Oh yes. I want to get on to the business of power. I think we have to look at, in addition to the sort of conversational rules that we've mentioned a little bit, we have to look at broader contexts of general social behavior and how they affect all of those assumptions that we bring into a conversation. We are, when we have discussions in socially determined relationships. Sometimes they're very explicit, they're well defined, like at work or in the military. You know who's boss and so forth. You have hierarchies that tell you where you are. These things influence your conversational stances and the sets of assumptions you bring to each conversation. We talked about the business of footing. Right, and you can imagine different situations where the footings are very important to the whole discussion. doctor-patient relationships, right? Mm-hmm. Doctors talk to patients differently, and then they talk to other doctors or their office staff. Patients talk to doctors differently than they do their relatives. Have you ever had, say, a brother or sister with you when you went to the doctor, say, for moral support, and then you get out and you have this argument, why didn't you tell the doctor about such and so? You know, the observer has a different set of assumptions than the patient. And of course, there are many motivations that might bring one not to say something to the doctor, or to many times patients, you know, will come in with their own diagnosis and say that to the doctor. Why didn't you let the doctor tell you what was wrong with you? And so your particular role in this relationship determines pretty much what it is you decide to bring into the conversation. And someone who's there in an observer role or a different relationship might have a different opinion as to what belongs there and what doesn't. All of these relationships express different degrees of involvement and independence, as we've mentioned. And in different relationships, you have, I think, different degrees of desire to establish things like rapport, solidarity. You know, you want to have that good working relationship with a coworker, but sometimes actually that's helped along if you all have the same bad relationship with the boss. Right? That nobody likes the boss's or the teacher's pet. Right? You have that good solidarity in the group if everyone labors under the whip cracking of the boss, and you can stand around the water cooler and say, I've still got 7 reports to finish by 4 o'clock today, and all of this other stuff, that all the ritual griping that goes on in groups with common purpose. You know, that's part of the fun of being in a particular group. You can have ritual griping. I suppose even in elder hostel groups, you can get around over coffee and have ritual griping over the mattresses or the teachers or whatever. You know? So, when all of these things happen, and you end up with these what you might call sometimes dysfunctional conversations, you can employ various strategies, stepping back like we talked about. If you can't fight it, study it. Take the observer stance. Now, what are we doing here? What's going wrong here? Sometimes that works. Sometimes it induces another argument. You can make allowances. You can think to yourself, try to imagine, you know, well, what's the person I'm talking to trying to achieve? Well, they're only trying to protect their own interests. You can imagine, try to imagine what those interests are. Put yourself in the other person's shoes. That's what that is. We sometimes don't have the presence of mind in the midst of one of those spiraling arguments to stop and do that. You can also now use avoidance techniques. Try and get out of this spiral. Change the frames, the footings. Sometimes it helps to articulate or express your things from your wrapper. Explain what it is that the assumptions you're coming from. Well, I thought that you were expecting me to do so and so. Actually, name what it is. Say where I'm coming from on this.
Sometimes you don't know what your wrappers are about, though, did you?
Particularly if there is passion, you know, there's anger, right? Mm-hmm. You begin to black out. You don't get analytic in that situation, right? You're shooting from the hip. Now, all of these these things are influenced, as I said, by power relationships that come from general social behavioral contexts. And we should perhaps a little bit look a little bit at models of social power. And I think for conversational purposes, they're fairly simple ones. There are vertical models where you have, let's say, people who belong to one. Let's have little boxes be categories or things, descriptors of people, right? And we think of this in classic terms. You know, we have obedience coming from the subservient, and this is your ladder hierarchical sort of model of power. And then, of course, you have authority coming down from the top. The military is the classic example here. Lots of workplaces are like this. And trust, insofar as we talk about it here, is top-down. That is that the bosses trust, they entrust certain things to the subordinates. And, of course, then if they prove themselves unworthy, they get fired or whatever. We also can speak of horizontal models. Or the peer model, where your boxes are sort of side by side and your arrows have arrows on both arrowheads on both ends. That is, you have authority going both directions. Everybody has authority in the group, and everybody has an obligation for obedience. And of course, to figure out who's doing what when requires negotiation. And we say that in this sort of organization, there is mutual trust. There's trust in both directions. Of course, when we think about life, you know, we'd much rather be in this sort of situation than this one. And we think there may be a little bit something wrong with someone who likes to be in the top box all the time, at the top of the pyramid, as it were. The one who always gets orders and gives orders and doesn't have to get any. And this is sort of an ideal model where, you know, things work harmoniously. And this is, you know, this is what utopian communities were invented to make, so that there is only this and we get rid of all of this. But in fact, we all live in a social system that puts us into both kinds all the time, right? And in here, the premium is on the solidarity part, rapport. And, you know, over here, the premium is on the use of authority, the ability to speak directly and say, you do this. And of course, speech patterns are characteristically different in both kinds. In this one, you get more indirectness, right? Because you have authority, you don't want to go out and grab the authority and turn your box up here, make it vertical. And so you use more indirectness. You follow that maxim of give options. And you say things more indirectly, like instead of saying, we're going out to dinner tonight, you say, I think it'd be nice to go out to dinner tonight. That's less direct. It invites the other person to either agree or disagree or make a counterproposal. It starts a negotiation. It doesn't say some absolute thing, which to disagree with is at the cost of direct confrontation, right? Comment, yes?
Another way of depicting the vertical and horizontal is, say, the vertical model that is a goal-oriented.
Yes.
Whereas the horizontal is relationship-oriented.
That's right. This is very relational. Right? Yes.
Where is Holy Village?
Well, I think that communities like Holden are always trying to achieve something like this. And of course, it gets down to a point in some things where to get something done, you have to use a little of this. And so you might say that it's ideally one of these with the judicious use of this, right? There has to be a head maverick who tells the other mavericks to pick up that heavy thing over there and move it over there, because when it comes down to it, there are some situations where you just need to have lines of authority, right? You will see this if we should have a fire drill, you will see that for the safety of the community, there very suddenly everything snaps into a vertical mode and the fire chief is the chief. Tells the directors what to do and everybody else. And that's for a particular reason. That's efficiency and safety. So there are places for these different models. The secret in having a conversation is knowing which kind of model you're operating in. Where the power relationships go. That's why we have institutions that carefully define how they go. And of course, most of those institutions work this way. They're hierarchical. Yes?
But I guess back to the router kind of thing, mm-hmm. and the indirectness, sometimes that is used in the authoritarian manner. We're using indirectness to express a situation that is really going to be this way. Like, I know some people who say, I would like to, or maybe we should go out to dinner tonight.
Yes.
What that means is, we're going to go out to dinner tonight, or I'm going to be angry. But we don't say that, so. But that's the result if you don't come.
Yes, you see, there's a kind of miscommunication that we were talking about where you send the wrong signal in the wrapper. Mm-hmm. It's not saying what you mean. Sort of in the reverse, you know, that you didn't signal what stake you have in this thing actually coming true. You made it less clear, less direct than you should have. So people might misconstrue that and say, oh, well, she's only opening a negotiation. Let's make some omelets and stuff or sandwiches and stay home, you know, and then the sort of disappointment begins. And since you did it, if you started out this way in a very indirect manner, then you have a great deal of difficulty bringing your disappointment out directly as well. Right, because you've started this conversation on a particular premise, and then here you are going along, and you've got this baggage or this disappointment here, and you can't come out and say, "Well, I didn't really mean that. I really want to go out." You know, well, if you're depending on the relationship, you can, right? You can backtrack and say, "I should have put that differently. I really want to go." And I'm almost insisting, you know, I insist we go. And you can repair that. You can repair that. But, yes.
Oh, I'm still impressed with Hogan Billy's, but from what I understand you just told me, this is necessary. The vertical is necessary.
Yes.
But then those who are in the top in Hogan try to forget that they're at the top and try to be peers.
Yes.
This is necessary and established, but that's the way you want to operate the thing.
Yes.
Now, in switching changes here, can a peer become the superior in an instant? In fire,
yes.
That's barely, you know, if there's a fire, that's a clearly defined problem. But in the other problems, can these two relationships harmoniously exist?
Well, I guess that's part of the experiment of communities like this, isn't it?
I was thinking along the same line. It seems to me that if the community that horizontally agrees that there will be times when authority will be given,
yes.
then it's different than when authority is assumed or taken.
Yes.
And so it seems like there might be a third model. where there is a kind of cooperative agreement that there will be times when we have vertical, and maybe it's not even vertical, maybe it's just, this is your realm of authority, this is my realm of authority, this is your, you know,
yes,
that the authority is shared, and so in this situation, you get to be direct, and in this situation, I get to be direct, but it's a cooperative.
Yes, there is authority that is parceled out by expertise, for example. When the utilities manager says, I'm turning off the power at 6:30, we don't have a vote as to whether it should be at 8:15 or 10.
My problem is, if I'm as Sue is in charge of some function, and I don't know, when she tells me something, if it's an order, or can we, you know, can I disagree with it because I don't believe, you know, I have a different opinion, and how do you know at any given, I mean, of course, fire and turning off the power are distinct things,
yeah.
But I mean, in general, how do I differentiate whether it's sir or whether it's all no?
I'll tell you,
we need to go back to basics here.
Maybe. The only way to tell for sure how it actually functions, I think, might be to go as an observer several weeks in a row to staff meeting.
Well, in relationships and holdings.
Yeah. And you know, and it's not perfectly one or the other sometimes. And that, I remember last summer, you know, Sven, the chief carpenter, every staff meeting would get up and ask for power tools to be returned to the shop. You know, everyone has, in a sense, the authority to use the power tools, but then Sven, who has the ultimate authority over the power tools, was getting frustrated because they were always walking out of the shop and not making their way back. And that's the kind of situation where those two models kind of meet.
Isn't it a matter of responsibility? Somebody has
yes.
to be volunteer to be responsible and either
right.
wants to be responsible or...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you do in the case when you have the authority in a vertical organization and you give a command and then they want to negotiate like mm-hmm. in the horizontal organization?
Well, that happens, doesn't it? Yeah, and that's you know, there are attempts to sort of mix these models where the people down in this box have a different idea of what's going on than the fellow up in this box, right?
That's the way it is in marriage. That's what he's talking about,
Are you suggesting that one spouse might think of it in this model and the other one in this one?
And it's true with management styles too.
Yes.
It's the same thing. Some people prefer one and it works, and some people
That's
prefer
right.
another, and they prefer to work under one or the other, and it just varies with
yeah.
members.
Or can I pick the box I want when I want it?
You know, that happens. That, you know, which mode are we in, you know? And there are attempts, formal attempts, to sort of mix these things. The Supreme Court, for example, runs on this model that is an attempt to mix this. It's called the First Among Peers, where the Chief Justice is just another justice, but is also the one they've elected to be the one who's the spokesman for the court and the leader of the court and has more control over the agenda of the court and so forth.
Sure.
And I think you could look at the directors of Holda Villages along that model, the First Among Peers, and in fact there are three of them. And not one of them, and you can't name one of them who's sort of the boss of all bosses or something like that. It's a very complicated situation, and I think people recognize that in practice there's no pure organization like this. In theory, the military always works this way. In theory. But in practice, you know, that's a different story, right? Okay. So your speech is a reflection of your social and cultural background, reflecting your relationships of power, and consequently, in given situations, there are times when you speak and times when you don't speak. And with reference to this business of authority, you sometimes have the authority to say something and sometimes not. Right? When it comes to the business of hose houses and fire brigade training, the fire chief has the authority to speak. In other things, the fire chief in Holden doesn't say a word, like when to bake the bread. And that's true throughout cultures, and I think after the break, it's about time for break, we'll come back and we'll start looking at some of those social factors that determine when it is you can pipe up and when you have to keep quiet, and how that's influenced by your power relationships. Second session here. Order in the court, as they say. We're back rolling the tape there. I wouldn't have that job for...
She's been very patient.
Even when he gets mad, he does it with dignity.
I hope we can have some time today to get into the business of courtroom language. That's a real can of worms. As I was saying there are times when we have the authority to speak on something and times when we don't. And this is very cultural. I can tell you that how I have participated in many meetings with Native people in British Columbia and how meetings there work. They don't work so much on this, although they have this kind of hierarchical authority. It is very much a mixed kind of thing. It's what I call a last word society. The one who is accorded the last word is the one who essentially decides. But they don't speak generally very much during the debate. And I have seen the case where we have a meeting and there are a bunch of Native leaders there. And by the way, these meetings usually are about 7 hours. If you have three or four chiefs in the room, you know you're going to have at least as many speeches towards the end as there are chiefs. And nobody ever tells a chief when he's done. And of course, the big chief is last. That's the guy with the last word. But they will discuss this stuff at length. And people will be, the chief will suddenly pipe up, well, we haven't heard from you. What do you think about this? And they'll listen. They are very good listeners. And then at the end, the chief summarizes what was said, and everybody takes that away. That's what's going to be. His summary or her summary. They're female chiefs, and a woman in line for the...
Are you speaking about a Native group?
Yes, Native groups. One of the Salish groups. We have a joint program in the interior BC with the Shuswap Nation. That's one of the interior Salish groups. And they, we have this joint steering committee, and we have a co-chair from the university and one from, the, and a chief from there. And if, the meetings generally run on their system. You know, we don't sit there and have agendas and votes and all that stuff. We have this kind of consultative style with the summary at the end, and that's what they write down in the minutes, what the chief said. But it's interesting that there is a very definite time when you can speak. You get your chance, and then it's someone else has the authority to speak. And this gets to be an extreme. For example, in some Salish cultures on the coast, things like age are important factors. And it one of the principles is it's not polite to flaunt knowledge. So when a question for information is asked, it's very important to figure out who is entitled to answer it. You may know the answer, but it's not like here where everybody pipes up with the answer. The oldest person in the room is deferred to, and they may decide, well, why don't you answer that? They'll delegate it, or they'll answer it, or whatever. And when schools first came into this area, the children were classed as very unteachable because the teacher would go in and ask questions and they wouldn't answer them. And they'd be sitting there thinking, well, the teacher must know the answer to that. She's the one entitled to answer it. You know, like, what's 2 plus 2? If you wanted the child to answer, what's 2 plus 2, you wouldn't make it a question. You'd say, tell me what 2 plus 2 is. You give a direct command. Questions have an entirely different status. And these people are so laconic, that is, that they do not make small talk whatsoever. And so you might ask someone, would you come over to my house tomorrow night about 8:30? And they just look at you and not say anything. Because if they don't have the answer, they won't answer it. But 2 hours later, they might walk up to you and say, yes. I mean, there's almost none of this little sort of banter back and forth and so forth in this society. Not much rapper, you know.
That's where Northern Exposure, I think, was so interesting because of the Native American.
That's right.
She would just display the Maryland would just display
yes.
it so yeah. well.
Yes. And actually, in real life, she is from a tribe that is not too distantly related from the one I'm speaking of. The ones I'm talking about are over in the Nooksack Valley across the way, the Lushootse, and further down there, North Washington group.
When you were talking about chiefs and rank, you mean within the same tribe or within different tribes?
Well, within the same tribe, and also they have layers of chiefdom that go higher than that within tribes, because they have these different councils of different levels and, you know, multiple nation things.
The ranking within a tribe, but when two tribes are together, which chief is the big chief?
Well, usually then they get into an elective system. Right, that there'll be a number of hereditary chiefs who are eligible for election to be the big chief, right? And then a particular tribe will send their big chief to a council, and that council will elect a big chief.
Okay.
And there in Canada, for example, there is the Grand Chief of First Nations, and he is the big chief. And when the Native people want to say something to Parliament, he's the one out front at the microphone telling them. Like most recently when they came out with the gun control legislation, which calls for everything to be registered, you know, all guns to be registered. The Native people decided they didn't like that because it infringed on their traditional hunting rights. So he was out there telling Parliament what for. Of course, he had to get in line because everybody else was, too. So in a sense, your relationships, and we've looked a little bit about relationships and how they are defined by power, determine your ability to speak in different situations. Now, as listeners, we're always assessing the authority of the speaker to speak. Right? Some people who get up and make pronouncements, we're going to dismiss right away. They don't really know what they're talking about. It might be a question of knowledge, or it might be a question of power authority that's entrusted to them. Well, let's listen to the guy who can really tell us what to do, rather than this fellow, pretenders, you know. And it's interesting about, as listeners, we're always assessing the credibility of someone. And someone's done a study of doctor-patient relationships and found that doctors who are real chummy and have nice little light conversations all the time and try to be pals to all the patients are rated by patients as less credible. You want a doctor to be real serious and, you know, actually the right combination of seriousness and friendliness. They want them to be serious enough to be credible, but still, of course, want some rapport with that doctor.
So
exactly what they found out in these studies. There's a very fine line to walk, because as soon as the doctor appears too chummy, the rating and credibility goes down. So there's a question of by whose authority do you speak and say something? And it's interesting that we have particular subset of language that is very closely tied to this. There is a system of verbs, which we linguists call performative verbs, which have to do with the kind of utterance you're making, what it is you're saying. There are ones that have to do strictly with information. They are the verbs of speaking. I say to you, I tell you, I declare. Most of these are verbs which, in a sense, create part of the wrapper for an assertion, right?
What kind of
verbs? We call them performative verbs. Performative verbs, and the interesting thing about them is there is a test word. You can tell if a verb is a performative verb. They're the only ones that can be used with hereby. I hereby declare to you that thus and so is true, right? So you say, I tell you hereby that tomorrow it's going to rain. You know, that's an assertion, right? Then there are the question verbs. I ask. I hereby request that you stop doing that. It's annoying me. These, in a sense, define a little bit the frame of what's going on here, because you can have different kinds of ones. Ask, request, question. Right? They come with characteristic clause types. They come with if, whether, and that sort of thing with the questioning ones. And of course, then there are the order ones. Right, I hereby order you to leave the building, or I command you, I instruct you. And those, the clause that goes after that is then an instruction. It tells you to do something. It requests action, the other one requests information, the other one just makes an assertion. That's interesting that, of course, which ones of these you can use depends a little bit on your power position, right? Like the order ones. When we're concerned about rapport and politeness, we tend not to use those. We might, as we said, use the question ones, being indirect. We also, aside from those performative verbs, which we say, in a sense, make a difference in behavior because they convey things like actions, or they elicit things like answers. These verbs are also accompanied by another set, which we have always called in linguistics the psych verbs, the ones that refer to interior states of people. I think, I feel. I intend, I want. They express very personal things. And so you can, in a sense, express things directly about the wrappers that you're delivering by saying, this is not an assertion about facts, but it's a feeling, right? And that can add a dimension of indirectness here. You know, I think we should do that, I want to do this, and so forth. Also believe, you express beliefs rather than absolute knowledge, and things like that. So there is the issue of when you can speak, let's say, for someone else. Where is your authority? You know, you can express your own point of view using the psych verbs. But when can you use, say, a performative verb, like one of the order verbs, to instruct people to do something? When is it your turn to take that position, assume that authority in one of these models to do that? And here we go. We come back to the business of directness and indirectness again. When you have clarity, when clarity is important, like in the fire situation, you find that directness has the biggest payoff. You get more clarity from directness than you do indirectness. When you can use the order performative and say, I instruct you to go roll out that hose, everyone knows what's supposed to be done. Not, I think it would be nice to roll out that hose before the fire gets too far along. In speaking for someone else, indirectness has some payoffs too. And I think if you think in political terms, where you have responsibility, one of the favorite terms, if you remember some of the controversies of government, deniability is one of them. You use indirectness, and you can, like the Iran-Contra affair, you sort of beat around the bush about these missiles and who sold them to who and so forth forever. And then, of course, when the press comes and blows the whistle on you, you say, well, I didn't say exactly that. And so I never said we didn't do this and that. What you do many times when you're being indirect, like when you want to turn down an invitation and do it indirectly, you're inviting an inference. You're inviting the person that you're saying no to infer that they'd really like to say yes. And so indirectness can be used, in a sense, dishonestly. There are also honest uses of indirectness. For example, when everyone understands that indirectness is in place, then the signals are clear. In the case of the kid who wants to go to the movies, and the parent says, well, you can if you want to, the kid understands. Well, the parent is not terrifically enthused about this, but it's being left up to me. The ball's back in my court. How bad do I want to see this movie? You know, can I tell myself I didn't want to see it anyway and not go? Or is it really something I have to see? You know, and understand that, well, the consequence is a little bit of displeasure from mom or dad. You know, there everything is well understood. So I think what would be useful now, since we've already mentioned Judge Ito, is talk a little bit about these power relationships and how they get played out in court, because here is a case where we need this clarity. Right? You're taking a situation, the lawyers are in here and they're describing it and interpreting it. That's what they're paid lots of money to interpret it for you. And you're sitting there on the jury and you have to make sense of this. And what comes out of this, particularly when you consider this is adversarial, you're getting two points of view. You have to take out of a very muddled situation all of this information and make something exact, very clear about it. Now, first, I think we need to look at the language of judgment a little bit. One of the things about performative verbs is most of them have consequences. We use it, for example, in naming. The words for baptizing and naming are performative verbs. You christen a ship, you know, bang the thing, and you say, I christen this ship the SS Holden Village or whatever. And from then on, it has that name, right? You've used that word to actually do something. You've pasted a label on something with that word. If you think about it, that happens in court, too. I hereby sentence you to 25 years in prison. That's an utterance with a consequence. It makes a difference in the world. And you look at the structure of courts. We have these very complicated structures. We have vertical power structures. We have the law, which binds the judge. The judge who instructs the jury. I hereby instruct you to ignore that piece of evidence. There you are, poor, you know, feeling like a deer in a pair of headlights, you know. I just heard something and now he's telling me to ignore it. You have lawyers who are subordinate to the judge. as we have seen with the O.J. Simpson trial, that the judge is constantly warning, and you know, it's like unruly kids in a schoolroom, you know. out to the cloakroom, let's go. And then you have witnesses, and the witnesses are constrained by the law and the judge. They have to answer in certain ways. Sometimes they have to answer, and sometimes they're told, don't answer that. It's a very vertical situation. And then there are very significant horizontal power structures in the court, and the jury is the biggest one. Right? You have 12 peers, and they all have the authority to cast that no vote which hangs the jury. You also have a kind of horizontal relationship that is implicit because there's not direct discussion, but there is a horizontal power relationship between witnesses and the jury. The witnesses have enormous influence over the jury, and the presence of the jury affects very much how the witnesses speak. You know that we've had those little bits of hearing in the O.J. Simpson trial where the jury is not present, and the witnesses are suddenly much more free to say things, right? It's only the lawyers and the judge, and they're talking about, you know, matters of fact, and the question is whether or not the jury can actually hear these things, right? And after that's all sorted out, then the jury comes back in, and the witness knows which things to mention and which things are not allowed to be mentioned. So it's a very complex thing. You've got all of the... We had to draw a picture of a courtroom up here. We'd have arrows going all over the place. Arrows of authority and mutual trust and everything else. So we have all of these things that have these very... powerful performative verbs that go on. I allege that you did this. I accuse you of doing this. All of these things are good legal language. Deny. I deny that I did so and so. The judge finds and determines. The witnesses swear. I hereby swear that I'm going to tell the truth. And then, of course, at the end, the judge comes in with all kinds of heavy verbs of judgment. You know, I hereby sentence you, or the foreman of the jury gets up and stands up and gets to say, we the jury, acquit the defendant or convict. The judge rules all the time. Every day he's constantly ruling things, and that's the way it is. I hereby rule that that exhibit is inadmissible, you know, throw it out, the jury can't see it. Now, the law, as I said, somewhere in this hierarchy, the law is way up here, right? We have this body of law. It comes from two places, legislation. Here's this stuff written by the staff of various politicians and put down on paper, and it becomes the thing that binds the judge. And then, of course, we have that body of opinion written by other judges that comes along and interprets that law again. So we have all this information that the judge has to sift through and sort out and come up with the conclusions. And this, of course, the whole idea of this is to be as clear as possible. We get clarity in the law sometimes by precedent, and a precedent is a concrete example. You can say, well, if that guy did it this way, then maybe this applies here. And that's what interpretation is trying to interpret the concrete examples and decide how it applies to a given situation. Now, the thing about legal language is that metaphorical or indirect language is to be avoided. And so, to get clarity, we have to avoid indirectness. And when they write laws, they try to do this. Now, I know some people in linguistics who are in semantics who make a nice side income by going to court and testifying that a particular law is muddled, that commas are in the wrong places, and that you can't really tell what a particular sentence means. And this is a favorite one for some reason, and insurance lawsuits. The insurance company is saying, well, this sentence says we don't really have to pay in this case. But the law is intended to be, you know, it's like the theory of the military, that the lines of conclusion are very clear, right? You know who's in charge. You know what the law is supposed to say. Well, of course, in practice, that's not true. The logic of this law, to be clear, you have to have very concrete categorization of things. And so you may have muddled evidence, but you have to come out with one or the other result, right? For the jury, maybe isn't one of the answers they can come back with. It's either guilty or not guilty, right? And if they can't come with one or the other, then it's a hung jury, right? Now, it's interesting to look then at the sort of categories that have to do with the crime of murder or homicide, the more general one is homicide. And see what has happened. And this is going to be very relevant to the O.J. Simpson trial because it's going to come up. You remember that capital punishment was suspended for a while by the Supreme Court because of a matter in determining the sentence and exactly how the sentencing was done. Now, according to the more recent Supreme Court decision, that sentencing is a separate issue where capital punishment is involved. So first you determine the guilt of the person, and then there's a separate proceeding for determining the punishment. And if you take the general area of homicide, you find that the law breaks the categories down into very strict subparts. You have either murder or manslaughter. Yes, we'll go on with that one. That one gets more complicated. Now, what's the difference between manslaughter and murder? Okay. Intent, premeditation, is actually something more precise. Intent, right? This is unintentional homicide, and this is intentional. Now, and we're going to use the California system fortuitously. Reason. Robin Lakoff, who was a linguist who had to do jury duty on a murder trial, is from Berkeley. She was absolutely stunned that she even got picked for this jury. She thought for sure when she got called that both sides would reject her instantly. As she put it, an intellectual Berkeley female with a Jewish background, culturally, I figured I was just too loaded to satisfy either side, but she ended up in the jury, and they had to go through this. So she said it was really interesting to see the conversational dynamic in the jury room, which is something people never get to see. You know, you wanted to do field studies as a linguist, you'd never be let in there to do this. So they had a case that was either murder one or murder two. And here's where premeditated comes in, right? This is the difference. This is premeditated and murder two isn't. And of course, it's first degree murder, which is either capital or not. And so that there are two categories, the capital one. And of course, the first part of the trial is concerned up to this point. And then after a murder one conviction is returned, there's another proceeding to see whether it's a capital or a non-capital case. Now, this is what. Pardon?
What's the difference?
Well, that's where the judgment issue kind of goes off the rails, because the Supreme Court language on this got really funny, and they said, in a capital case, it's called there have to be aggravating circumstances. Mm-hmm. And to argue for a non-capital result, the defense argues for what they call mitigating circumstances. One of the defenses that's sometimes used in mitigating circumstances, and in the case that she was in, was post-traumatic stress disorder. It was a Vietnam veteran. And so the defense argued that as a mitigating circumstance. Aggravating circumstances are, this was a terrible, brutal crime, and look at the, you know, just the way that it was done and so forth. Aggravating circumstances would be sort of a gangland-style execution, that kind of thing.
Racial.
Yes. Now, the interesting thing is that this is the new part, right? This is what has to be now considered for capital punishment. The Supreme Court gave very little instruction. It just said the jury must weigh the aggravating and mitigating circumstances. Now, all along here, we've got homicide. The jury can be instructed. If you think it was intentional, then it's murder. If you think it was premeditated, then it's first-degree murder. And now you get over here and they say, now you weigh the aggravating and mitigating circumstance. And what kind of instruction is that? That is very hedged. It's, you know, it's metaphorical in the first place. What do you mean, weigh? This is one of those things that drives lawyers crazy.
That's so subjective.
That's right. That's right.
How about the jurors? It drives you crazy.
Well, yes, it does. And but the thing that she found in the jury room was that it was amazing how the decision was reached in a consensus, right? It has to be a consensus, you know, or it's a hung jury. And in a very relational sort of fashion, it was, of course, a long proceeding. And we get into this kind of thing, you spend several hours at the beginning figuring out what do these instructions mean. And she said that what happens is that there is a dynamic where the relationships are kind of defined. And at some point, there will be a point at which some of the people in the room assume a kind of authority. That is, that the listeners will grant them credibility, and someone will make a speech that will kind of make the difference. In this particular case, where there was the issue of the Vietnam veteran, it was a Vietnam veteran in the jury who got up and essentially for some time related some experiences there. This is what it's like. This is what this fellow has been through. And the result was the non-capital one. They declined to impose the death penalty, although it was interesting. They said out in the courtroom you could tell the prosecution thought, we've got this nailed down. Now, this is aggravating circumstances if we ever saw it. And it was a surprise to the prosecution. I don't remember whether she said they appealed it or not, but...
Well, it wouldn't matter. I mean, you can't... On an appeal, you don't get worse, you get less, or the same.
Well, I know the prosecution appeals. And I don't know whether it's even possible at this level, but... There are prosecution appeals. Although,
well, we're in pending trial.
No, I think they have the right to appeal.
I didn't know the jury could say non-capital punishment, and then some judge would say capital punishment.
Well, that's right. They can only appeal on an error of the judge, and allege that the judge made a wrong interpretation or something like that. That's right. They can't appeal the jury's verdict. That is now. And I think that's why this has been tacked on. They've given this responsibility to the jury to decide this. So that's a very interesting situation with respect to language here. The language leaves essentially a dilemma to the jury, and from what we can see, juries actually resolved this in that very sort of horizontal power structure, and it takes them a while to figure out, you know, just what these relationships are, these peer relationships within the jury room. And when they don't get resolved, of course, then the jury is non-functional. It can't reach a decision. And that...
You do need a leader type on the jury.
Yeah. Well, actually, you may have two or three people who have... You need a good leader to sort of arbitrate everything, but you can have several different people who have very credible positions within the relationships among the jury who then speak in a particular direction. If you have very credible people on different sides of the question, it can divide the jury into two camps, and then it doesn't work.
Any theories on why the jury has been so fragmented on the O.J. Simpson thing?
I have no idea. That's such a circus, it's difficult to tell. I hope they're studying that. I'm sure they are, just to see what's going on there. And, you know, there's a kind of a parallel case. It's not quite so high profile, but there is a case in Canada of widely known murder cases of three teenage girls, and the fellow on trial for that. It's one of those things. It was very sensational at the time. And he's gone on trial now, and what has happened here in this case is that the judge just imposed a complete blackout of news to the point where it is technically illegal to listen to stations in Detroit that were reporting information about the trial. and that's a very different approach that's been taken in there. The Simpson trial. It'd be interesting to compare the two. Well, I hear the coffee break bell, and I wouldn't want to keep you from your coffee break. So,
this is the end of class.
This is the end.